Hey everybody, what follows is most of a reading series we had last Saturday, September 13th, at Book Row in Brooklyn. It was a really nice gathering of friends, comrades, a couple of rats, and one very obnoxious flying cockroach, right beneath the JMZ tracks, which periodically interrupts the reading. There was also a malfunctioning soapbox that one of our readers fell through and got stuck in, so you'll hear that part. You'll have to imagine the slapstick for yourself. And in another minor tragedy, the batteries on my recorder ran out during Samantha Hines' excellent poem about Ulrika Meinhof, but she has that recorded, so I can just splice that in. And so I hope you can get a sense from this recording that there was a feeling there, and generally somewhat I felt this the whole past Anarchist Book Fair, that even though so many aspects of our freedom and autonomy and safety and security are under intensifying attack, we can at least for now still gather together to speak freely and freakily amongst one another and use spaces like these and create spaces like these to connect and keep building for all the horrors that are coming. And as a result, some of this does get a little spicy, so if you're listening to this on our free feed, you'll hear just the last part, which is me introducing Jared Shanahan and his excerpt from his new book, Every Fire Needs a Little Bit of Help, about a Mr. Bean-esque CO heist of a Dolly painting from Rikers Island. And the rest of it will be behind the paywall. So if you want to hear that, sign up at patreon.com/theantifada. And if you sign up at the superstar tier at the annual level, or if you upgrade your membership to that annual superstar tier, I will mail you Jared's book, Every Fire Needs a Little Bit of Help, A Decade of Rebellion, Reaction, and Morbid Symptoms, totally free, postage paid, while supplies last, assuming you're in the continental United States. I always appreciate your support, and here's the reading.
Thank you, Peyton. Rest in peace, Patrick Bateman. You would have loved Dime Square. All right, we're getting to the star of the show. A lot of you know him, but for those who don't, I've been very honored to have been asked to write the introduction to this new book. And so I'm going to read a little bit from that to introduce Jared Shanahan. Beyond Zinsser personalism and New Left Marxism, his contributions to recognizing and recording American cultural history especially stand out in his direct reports from within the eye of society's most ferocious storms. The second section of this book, for instance, describes his experience with America's carceral system, not as a social worker or undercover prison guard a la Shane Bauer, but as an inmate. His 30-day sentence was the result of a climactic march over the Brooklyn Bridge after Eric Garner's killer was cleared of charges in December 2014. During which he broke an officer's nose during a melee. In the days afterward, a citywide search for the perpetrators ensued, complete with a wanted poster featuring Jared's blurred face on the cover of the New York Post. A year and a half later, as Trump ascended through the Republican primaries, I visited Jared at Rikers Gymnasium. When I solemnly asked how he was, I was shocked that he excitedly answered, "Great!" He was filling his notebooks with every detail of Bastille life and his fellow inmate stories, he told me. When I asked if he was able to follow the news of the world, he grinned and said, "There was no need. I'm in the center of it." A year later, Trump was president, and Jared and I watched in horror as the alt-right smashed the Overton window wide open in a Gramscian attempt to transform the GOP into the Nazi Party. After the alt-right's fracture following Charlottesville, Shanahan continued to probe the narrative within the broader MAGA movement by enduring several Trump rallies, where some edgy social Democrats like Angela Nagel saw a blue-collar revolt against neoliberalism, Jared found instead an interconnected web of small-time hucksters, politicized police and border patrol, Christian chauvinists, ideological white supremacists and xenophobes, and local petty bourgeois prone to representing themselves as the white working class. After Trump lost his re-election, tens of thousands of this coalition mobilized to support his attempted coup by storming the Capitol to prevent the electoral vote tally on January 6, 2021. Some anti-fascists were so horrified to see Carhartt cosplayers battling their way through police lines that they regretted not mobilizing in defense of Biden and began participating in a campaign to identify the rioters and turn them over to the FBI. Jared, on the other hand, judged the moment to be a parodic but potent petty bourgeois recreation of the May 28th precinct burning that initiated the George Floyd rebellion. Fearing the significance of J6 and M28 alike would be lost, he wrote, "Collective actions like the siege of the Capitol register in the minds of millions of people the idea that drastic measures can be taken by ordinary people. What is our alternative?" Jared and I are, of course, not ordinary people. We are partisans of a centuries-long class war, students of its great theorizers like Hegel, Marx, Du Bois, James, and Ignatieff, and writers that connect isolated moments of proletarian rage through long cycles of burst and bust. We treat these great episodes the same way record collectors and film nerds do, often obscure genre raves, important marginalia, striving towards some culmination still past the horizon of Marxist prognostication. Everybody, Jared Shanahan.
Oh, I love you, Andy. Hey, thanks everybody so much for coming. This is awesome. Andy and I used to do readings like this all the time back in like 2010, 11, 12. It just means so much to me to be back in New York with a bunch of my new friends from Chicago, the Lake Effect Collective. You guys rock. And I'm going to read a little bit from the book. I know we've had a lot of readers. I'm going to let this pass. This is not the first time I've been interrupted by that train reading. Remember the place that Mr. Kiwi, like above Mr. Kiwi, they would have readings there. All right. So this book is a collection of essays spanning 10 years of political involvement and cultural analysis. I'm going to spare you the real dense stuff. And I'm going to tell a little story that actually touches down on Bushwick, the neighborhood that we're in. And it centers around Rikers Island. All right. In February 1965, Salvador Dali was invited to visit a Rikers Island prisoner art program by longtime commissioner Anna M. Cross. The wily reform commissioner appealed to the artist's thirst for publicity by promising a high-profile visit under the banner Salvador Dali Goes to Prison. When the appointed day arrived, however, Dali had fallen ill. Unable to fare on the frigid ferry ride that transit to Rikers Island required in the days before the Buono Memorial Bridge, and with the press impatiently awaiting his descent into the hotel lobby below, Dali seized a pencil and some India ink and got to work. Within 2 hours, he had produced The Crucifixion of Christ, an abstract though recognizable likeness of Christ on the cross, spattered in red blood, his head bowed, awaiting deliverance from the torturous punishment. It's tempting to imagine the image as a poignant reflection on the injustice of incarceration, told through the allegory of the tortured Christ, panting the wan prayer, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do." Alternatively, however, as one Dali biographer later remarked, the surrealist master was certainly somebody who could dash off a crucifixion when the need arose. In any case, satisfied with his work, Dali dedicated the drawing to the dinning room of the prisoners, Rikers Island, spelled with a Y, and deputized a friend to deliver it to the prisoners in his place. The drawing, though rudimentary, clearly bears the mark of its master's touch. "It's a bird's nest of dark lines," a critic later wrote, of the 3x5 foot piece. "Indecipherable at first glance. Then the cross comes clear, strong and clean and square. Then a man's bloodshot eye, glaring through a tangle of hair, possibly thorns. Then blood, or maybe just a stain," and that's a stain from its subsequent tenure in the prisoner's dining hall, "dripping down the long, ravaged body." Like all matters big and small on Rikers Island, the origins of the Dali drawing were soon forgotten amid the banal and terrifying humdrum of life in a 24-hour penal colony. The Crucifixion of Christ hung anonymously in a prisoner's dining hall at the Correctional Institution for Men, known today as the Eric M. Taylor Center, or EMTC, for 16 years until an incarcerated art critic pummeled it with a coffee cup, smashing its glass casing and permanently staining the paper beneath. Removed from the dining hall, the work subsequently spent some time in mothballs, briefly featured in a gallery exhibit on prison art, and eventually found its way to the staff corridor of EMTC because, as one warden later rationalized, prisoners couldn't understand it, they couldn't appreciate it, and they thought some crazy person put it there. Hanging in an obscure corridor, unseen by practically anyone, least of all prisoners, the artwork once more slipped quietly into the island's memory hole. And there it would remain, save for the faint murmuring among the few guards who beheld it on a daily basis, of its mythical price tag. Wouldn't it be funny to take it? Assistant Deputy Warden Benny Nuzzo pulled a group of colleagues and subordinates gathered in the EMTC commissary in October 2002. Like most jokes, this was simply tentatively proffered truth-telling. Nuzzo planned to steal the drawing and was recruiting accomplices. Thanks to his joke, Nuzzo enlisted fellow Assistant Deputy Warden Mitchell Hoshhauser, and by February, the duo had recruited Timothy Pena and his carpool buddy, Gregory Sokol, two captains who could be stationed in the hallway the artwork called home. The plan Nuzzo masterminded was an ornate cloak-and-dagger escapade. The high-ranking quartet orchestrated a late-night fire drill to be announced by Hoshhauser in order to distract the guards working within sight of the Dali. If any guards failed to vacate the corridor, as ended up occurring, the captains could simply order them off by citing their superior rank, as they ended up doing. The captains were then free to use Nuzzo's keys to open the locked case, remove the drawing, and replace the crucifixion of Christ with a forgery that Nuzzo had composed based on several months of reconnaissance and some surreptitious Polaroid photos. Nuzzo, who would direct the whole operation, could then spirit the artwork off the island in the trunk of his SUV. Once off the island, Nuzzo anticipated selling the artwork for $500,000, $400,000 of which he would split with his fellow Assistant Deputy Warden Hoshhauser, and the remaining $100,000 he would divide between their subordinates, Sokol and Pena. The heist itself went off more or less without a hitch. In spite of this, or more accurately, because of it, the theft of the crucifixion of Christ soon earned a place in the colorful annals of art theft history, not simply for its peerless status as occurring within a prison, but more broadly for its sheer ineptitude. We will let the train go by as you soak in the details thus far. It turned out that Nuzzo had laid the perfect plan, save for one detail. The forgery failed to fool anyone. From its immediate discovery by a pious guard who prayed daily to the crucifixion of Christ and therefore knew the original quite well, a consensus quickly spread across EMTC that the artwork hanging on the wall that morning was not the same one that had been there the day before. It looks like the painting has been replaced by a copy, a DOC spokesman reported. That appears to be the case based on a consensus of non-expert opinion, people who work near the painting and see it day in, day out. The opinion, however, needed not to be expert. Nuzzo's forgery was, for starters, comprised of different coloration and different proportions than the original, striking the observer immediately as brighter and otherwise just different. It had moreover been composed with different materials. Instead of India ink on paper, it was oil paint on canvas, and canvas of a different size than the original drawing. In terms of quality, witnesses described the forgery as appearing to have been crafted by a child, and one lacking artistic talent, even for a child. That's a direct quote. Worst of all, Nuzzo's forgery was affixed to the wall with staples instead of its gilded frame, which had simply vanished. In its place, a new frame had been lazily painted directly onto the canvas. It wasn't even gold. There's no question, an investigator concluded. The real one is in the wind. A DOC spokesman put a finer point on it. What's there ain't the real thing. This unanimous sentiment likely did not come as a complete shock to all conspirators. Anybody who comes up here is definitely going to see that this is a duplicate, Sokol later recalled telling Nuzzo, who was nonetheless satisfied with the forgery and gave it his stamp of approval. Nuzzo, as a fellow assistant deputy warden, Hawkhauser, agreed with Nuzzo that the forgery would suffice, quieting all dissent. The skeptical Sokol, for his part, complied with his superiors. As the embarrassing story spread, investigators turned up the heat on the tiny circle of Reichert's staff who could have carried out the heist. Pina flipped immediately, implicating Sokol, who himself began to cooperate with the state, implicating all the others. As the final insult, the irreplaceable artwork, dedicated to the prisoners of Rikers Island by Salvador Dali, was by all accounts destroyed by Nuzzo in a blind panic. In the aftermath, three of the four conspirators were convicted and all four were fired. Despite the testimony of his co-conspirators and considerable circumstantial evidence, Nuzzo rejected a plea bargain and opted instead for a jury trial, in which he was miraculously found not guilty. He was nonetheless fired after a search of his mother's Bushwick home for the missing artwork discovered a trove of office supplies stolen from Rikers Island. Okay. The resulting media coverage made light of the thieves as a quartet of hopelessly inept bunglers, ill-suited for a life of crime. In contrast, of course, to those that they guard. The admittedly droll affair became a citywide punchline. Rikers Island just got a little less surreal, quipped the New York Daily News in an article subtitled, It's Goodbye, Dali. The ordinarily staid New York Times took to its own headlines to dub the plot far from a masterpiece. This is the best that M Service has ever fucking been. All right. The city had a good chuckle, and then, like the drawing itself, the story vanished. In recent years, however, with the proliferation of online content farms and the increasing notoriety of Rikers Island, the case of the Dali heist has resurfaced episodically in clickbait article after rehashed clickbait article, recounted over and over in nearly identical detail. And in all fairness, as I can attest, it actually is a really fun story to write. Even when told well, however, as James Finelli of Esquire accomplished in a 2008 return to the caper that featured interviews with principal characters and oodles of juicy new details, the story remains a mere object of curiosity, devoid of context, and offered up as an entertaining chaos yarn somewhere between the Coen brothers and the Marx brothers. But between the shop-worn trope of quote-unquote stupid crooks, with which writers are all too willing, though with no shortage of evidence, to frame the story, a simple question has never been satisfactorily addressed. How on earth did they expect to get away with it? I find this neglected question to be illuminated by an unlikely source. An extensive 2014 report by the Department of Justice on the systematic and long-term guard violence against adolescent prisoners on Rikers, including at the facility from which the Dali was stolen, and it also describes the considerable manipulation of official records that accompanies this violence. This report is most famous for chronicling the island's long-standing, quote-unquote, culture of violence, and it played an important part in what became the zeitgeist favoring the closure of Rikers Island for good. This is the 2014 DOJ report. It also helps explain why Nuzzo and company were comfortable enough to risk their lucrative careers switching the work of a master painter with an apparent finger painting. As part of this, quote-unquote, culture of violence, the report found adolescent prisoners to be not only regularly assaulted by brutal guards, but subsequently told to, quote, hold it down, meaning to not report the assault or to seek medical attention that would thereby create documentation. When their injuries are so serious as to require medical attention, assaulted prisoners are instructed to report quote-unquote slip-and-fall accidents in official paperwork, which the DOJ found to be widespread. This obfuscation, which the DOJ found ran up and down the chain of command, functions not just to protect individual guards from charges of assault, but generally to keep the island's quantified instances of violence down, which is of keen interest to its bureaucrats at the top, covetous of favorable statistics. The DOJ also found that the formerly prohibited practice of punching prisoners, including in the face, is nonetheless widespread among Rikers guards. In their subsequent paperwork, punches are rhetorically recast as sanctioned quote-unquote control holds, or described as quote-unquote guiding detainees to the floor. Such quote-unquote use of force reports, which is itself a bureaucratic euphemism, regularly state that the responding guard was assaulted, quote-unquote, out of nowhere by prisoners. This narrative is almost always upheld, even in the absence of any injury on the part of guards, and sometimes against considerable evidence that the guard violence was unprovoked, including testimony by prisoners. Moreover, guards cynically utter the phrase, stop resisting, as they assault prisoners, in order to justify assaults as a response to prisoners allegedly resisting more peaceful forms of coercion. The DOJ found the phrase stop resisting features prominently in these quote-unquote use of force reports. The DOJ also found that the creative writing process underlying these reports is not done in secret by individual rogue guards, but it is instead a common and communal act, the product of concerted efforts conducted out in the open. Reports made by multiple guards who witness and partake in violent incidents are often written in identical language. This indicates not only a widespread practice of conspiring to get a story straight before putting it down on paper, but also a lack of concern that this process will be detected by superiors. Even the existence of contradictory video evidence, when not quote-unquote lost or compromised by a camera conveniently pointed away from a violent act, as at a strategic moment, which often happens, even the existence of video footage is sometimes not enough to discredit the guards' stories, as these accounts move up the chain of command. In the rare case that a red flag is raised and superiors cannot turn a blind eye to the patent falsehoods on paper, the guards usually don't have too much to worry about. Instances of censure for violence typically amount to a quote-unquote retraining, consisting of some seminars and video screenings. Throughout this process, captains and assistant deputy wardens like Nuzzo, Hockhauser, Pina, and Sokol, remember them? They play a key role in sanctioning and sometimes crafting the alternative reality that becomes the official story of guard violence against prisoners. The DOJ report details how quote-unquote use of force reports make their way up the chain of command uncontested, no matter how questionable, and are essentially rubber stamped by the highest authorities on the island. Almost no investigation is ever mustered, absent considerable external pressure. The word of a guard who has used violence against a prisoner, no matter how absurd, is almost as good as truth at the moment it's scrawled down on paper. By the time it gets to the top, it becomes ordained as nothing short of God-given truth, even when significant conflicting evidence is available. The result is the systematic institutional acceptance at face value of improbable and sometimes outright ridiculous stories, which are at times contradicted by empirical evidence. In light of the DOJ report and other accounts of how the books are cooked on Rikers Island, the case of the Dali art heist seems less like the sort of tragicomic tale of stupid crooks so amusing to tabloid news consumers, and becomes instead a vivid portrait of how reality and truth are constructed by state power to cover up traumatic violence meted out against powerless people. After all, if a captain says a punch in the face is a control hold, and a deputy warden can dismiss video evidence in favor of an incoherent account offered by an assaultive guard, then surely four of such high-ranking Rikers officials working together can claim that a poorly conceived forgery of Dali is in fact an original Dali, and have that be the final word. And if the frame is missing, so what? It never existed. It's telling that when the forgery failed to deceive, the four thieves went into a panic and had no idea what to do. They were in the throes of a new experience. It had likely never occurred to them that what they decided would constitute reality would be questioned, especially by their underlings. Even Sokol, who saw the forgery for the failure that it was, took comfort that his superiors could cloak it in the usual mantle of bullshit behind which they were all accustomed to hiding. The subsequent unraveling of their plot tells us almost nothing about their aptitude for crime, for which countless Riker's officials have distinguished themselves over the years. Instead, it tells us much about the dangerous malleability of reality itself in the violent maw of Riker's Island and all institutions of human caging, rotten beyond all reform. Thank you so much for coming.
All right. Keep it going for Jared Shanahan, everybody. And for all the other readers, thanks for everyone who read. Thank you to Griffin and Sarah from Book Row. They're going to stay open a little bit longer, so check out the books they have and don't leave home empty-handed. Buy some journals, buy some books. Support OK's Top Surgery, buy some zines. And yeah, let's all hang out. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thanks, Andy.
Every fire needs a little bit of help. Nothing ever burns down by itself.